outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
Last time we did this, I was in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I was with Jeff Andreessen.
Yes.
And Jeff's back in the house, but he's not in his house. He's in my house.
Yeah.
Welcome to California, Jeff.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for the walk today. That was fun.
We got almost 3 miles in with the pups and Sarah, and Jeff's a good friend, United Airlines pilot. Wow, that was... How about American Airlines pilot? We had him on the podcast, gosh, somewhere in October, November, Where the Trails End, something like that, I think we called it.
Beyond Your
Where
Maps.
Where the maps... Oh, Beyond the Maps.
Yeah, your maps run out.
Yeah, and we talked about adventure stuff. A lot of response to that podcast from a lot of people, to me, to the website, and you got a lot personally, too. And
yeah, that was fun.
In fact, I've seen you on a lot of podcasts since, so we kind of launched your career into the podcast world, did we?
Yeah, I love it.
You love it. That's why you came back to California, saying, I want to do another podcast with Wayne.
Best thing about your dad.
Best thing about my dad?
Yeah.
He's still alive, so.
I know. But same with mine. They're the same age,
same age,
I think.
94 years
94,
old.
Yeah. Best thing.
Best thing about my dad is, he was my father of faith as well as flesh.
Yeah.
So. And yours?
Yeah. You know, I think all the adventures he took me on, he not only made me an adventurer, but a historian, I think. I could just go back into my own story and the places that he took me to give me context in my life. And so I love him for the adventures he took me on.
Well, my dad worked my tail off in the vineyard, so we didn't get all that adventuring. We did go camping, hunting, and fishing and that kind of stuff, but that's probably about it.
I can remember being 12 years old. We're in a constellation. We go up to, we went up to Alaska, then down to Okinawa and into Vietnam in 69. So we're flying supplies in and bodies out.
And taking my 8-year-old child with me.
And 12. He's, 12 yeah, I'm 12, 12 years old, and wow. I'm going with him. But it was amazing because we'd be out over the Pacific, the sun would go down, the stars would come out, and the navigator would actually take me into the back of the airplane. I would look up, and we would shoot the stars, and then he took me down to the table and plotted us across the Pacific. And it was absolutely beautiful watching that sunset in the Pacific, like this midnight blue descends out of the heavens, and we just get enveloped in this darkness. And it was so cool to learn how to navigate in this world by looking at another world.
Yeah, I think we talked about that in the last podcast.
Yeah.
Those of you who want to go back and grab at that, you might have a look at it. Most adventure I had with my dad, 16-year-old, got me out of bed one night to go cast some demons out of a house.
And,
yeah, because he couldn't find any other quote-unquote men available. So at 16, I was indoctrinated into a full-on demon hunt and get it out of the house. And actually did all that.
Wow.
And so, yeah, my 16, that was an adventure. And it was an adventure in another world, too. It wasn't.
Yeah.
It was another
without
world
a doubt.
Completely. So you're off today because, what, you fly the MCAS plane and it's not flying today?
I'm the Airbus guy, so I don't know anything about the MCAS at all. I saw a great comic the other day. It was a flight attendant in distress calling and asking everybody in the back of the airplane if there were any pilots on board because the two up front got ill. And one of the guys raises his hands and says, I fly an Airbus. And she looks and she goes, yeah, are there any pilots on board?
Ooh.
And
Is it so easy to fly? Is that it?
No, we point the airplane now. You don't even fly. You just kind of point us. We have a side stick and everything. It's
and
crazy.
You just punch in where you want to go and when you want to land. And
so automated. So it's such a smart bird, though.
Really?
Yeah.
You like flying it?
You know, somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, somebody's got to do it. And you fly to all these exotic Caribbean destinations and – hang out on beaches, and it's a tough life.
Yeah.
And do a bit of reading, I understand.
Yeah, L.A., that's where I fly. That's exotic, coming in here. That's always an experience.
But you weren't piloting out here, were you? You were
no.
Jumped on another airplane.
Yeah.
Somebody else and came in here.
I am here because of...
Because you want to do this podcast.
Yeah, well,
follow up some
I'm here because you keep giving me books that I'll read it, and I'm like, okay, that was like the best book I ever read. And so we have this relationship with books. Started with Wind, Sand, and Stars. Actually started with The Shack. And then it was Wind, Sand, and Stars by St. X.
And now we're on The City.
Yep.
And you're
right.
Not done with it yet.
No, we're right in the middle of it.
And other people are going, why can't I read it? You know, hold on. We'll get it to you.
You're
going to
love it. It's an adventure. Best experienced rather than talked about, actually.
As most good things are.
Yes.
Better experienced than explained, I think. Yeah, so we started with Wind, Sand, and Stars. I read it just because it was fun to read, and I knew you being a pilot and a lot of history in flying because your dad was a pilot, so you would love it too.
Best flying book I think I ever read. So if you – we'll put this on the podcast. So if you want to – somewhere down at the bottom, if you want to get this book.
Well, you're promising I'm going to put stuff on the podcast.
I'm putting you to work. I have no problem doing
I do.
But Saint X, and he's the one who wrote Little Prince. But in this book, it's a flying book. He writes, "We are true immigrants who have not yet found our homeland." And so this guy winds up being not only a man of machinery but of poetry. And it's a fantastic book.
You're obviously thinking about faith when you read that kind of thing, right?
Oh, yeah.
Was he?
Was very spiritual.
Right, but was he reading it that way, or was he just talking about the whole newness of aviation and this whole land we're going to explore? I think that's how he meant it primarily.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I love the other application of it. I love that, man, we are immigrants. That's immigrants with an E. I know immigrants with an I. Everybody's supposed to hate them, which is really silly. I have great friends who are undocumented immigrants here in the world, so I don't think we ought to hate them. But boy, the idea that we don't really belong here. I think one of the things I've noticed about Christianity, back when I was young, it was people who were so heavenly minded, they were no earthly good, and there was that problem. Mm-hmm. Now we've kind of transitioned to Christianity is all about being happy and fulfilled here.
Right.
And we don't have that sense that we're adventurers in another land. We really don't belong here. We seek a more eternal city, a city that we do not yet inhabit, but are beginning to explore the realities of in this age. And that gets all but lost now. So a lot of Christians are not adventurous. They're just following a bunch of rules and doing what someone else told them they ought to do.
Well,
drives me nuts.
If you want to read that, look on National Geographic top 100 adventure books of all time. And I think Wind, Sand, and Stars might be number 3 on there. And if you love that, you could start reading the others. Burl Markham wrote West by Night on there. So it's the Worst Journey I Ever Took was on there. It just – so he gave me this book, and I think I read 10 other books right after it.
Cool.
On that list.
Cool.
And everybody I fly with, I recommend this book to. And then we went off to so while we're talking about reading, I want to ask you a few questions.
Oh no.
All right. So you go into Barnes and Nobles. This is for your listeners who
I go in Barnes and Noble?
Let's just say you walk in there.
I have not been to a Barnes and Noble in at least 15 years.
All right, you walk into a bookstore.
You walk into
a bookstore. Which direction do you go?
This is funny. I used to be in bookstores all the time. My favorite space. I've not been to a bookstore in 15 years. I just browse Amazon and find what I want. Yeah,
I
think I was in a bookstore with you a few months ago.
Yeah,
back,
that's
but
right.
I haven't been in one other than that.
That's a good bookstore.
Yeah, it is a good bookstore. But those are those locally owned kind of things.
Okay, so you get down there and you start browsing. Where do you go?
Last time
what section do you go to? What are you mostly drawn to? You go to like the mysteries, you go to history, you go to – what do you go to?
I don't. Right now, last time I walked in Barnes & Noble, I actually remembered about a year and a half ago, I took my grandson in there. There was hardly any books in the store.
Yeah.
It's gifts and games and maps and whatever. Anyway, if I was going to a bookstore, I was usually looking for fiction.
Yeah,
but it all depends on what I'm in the mood for. So I read such a broad array of reading material that I'm in a mood. I'm looking for a good book on history. I'm like founding fathers stuff, natural history. I love that stuff. I love old European history as well. So I've read a lot of that stuff. It depends on what mood I'm in. Sometimes I just want a light fiction just to totally escape in and enjoy a good whodunit mystery thriller kind of thing. So,
yeah. My wife found the perfect shirt for me. It says, "History buff, I would find you much more interesting if you were dead."
And you're directing that to me with my picture on it?
No.
Okay, good.
I'm the same way. I go to the history.
You don't
section
have a you don't have a section you turn to?
I want a book. I've thought about this. I want a book that moves me, and I love a book that helps me understand the story that I'm living in. And so anything that like the next book, Lindbergh. And then the American Moonshot, anything that gives me context to my own story, I love that.
How did Lindbergh give you context for your own story?
Oh, all of his career after flying the Atlantic was opening up proving runs for Pan Am. So he's going out to Greenland, he's going to the Caribbean, and it was only all during that period that's where my dad was flying. And then he would take me with him. So much of what I was reading in Lindbergh was bringing me back to my own story. Yeah, we just lived it out.
Yeah, I sent you, I think, a picture of the book because someone had recommended it to me. And I figured you had probably read it. So I sent you a thing, and it was a New York Times bestseller. So I just sent you a picture and said, have you read this? And you went back and I just ordered it or something.
Yeah.
So I was looking for, is it worth my money to buy this book? And so we ended up reading it kind of together.
It was unbelievable. It was one of the best books I ever read. Now, the important part is you got to read that author. Scott Berg, is it?
Yep.
Is there an initial in there somewhere?
It might be, but I don't remember initials. Yeah. That's why I don't use them on my books.
Yeah. Well, what I was impressed with, I just didn't really understand the life of Lindbergh. And it was he had an epic life.
Well, yeah. When I think about, you know, what's Lindbergh? Lindbergh's the guy that flew across the ocean and then lost a baby in a kidnapping, something or other. So that's really all I knew. And when that's over in the first, the prologue, he's already landed in Paris. And you go,
right,
son of a gun, what's this book about then? And then you get through that and the kidnapping, but it keeps going on. His influence in aviation and history and politics and
unbelievable. Yeah, it didn't stop with the Atlantic. It just opened it up. And so it seemed like everybody had to write something about him after he did the crossing. And F. Scott Fitzgerald writes that he was a young Minnesotan who had not much to do with this culture, but did a very heroic thing. And everyone in the speakeasies and in the country clubs put their glasses down and thought about their old best dreams. And I think that this is what a guy that experiences the frontier does for us. It just calls us back and we remember and we think about the possibilities.
Hmm. Yeah. So that was is that primarily about the flight itself?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody wanted to have a word in there. You know, Churchill had something to say, everybody. But I love what F. Scott Fitzgerald, you know, yeah, we put our glasses down.
Yeah, and in this day and age, he'd probably, you know, if he'd have done something like that now, he'd probably have a Twitter follower of 20 million and never anything again with the rest of his life. He actually tried to avoid the celebrity trapping thing and get back to what he really loved, which was aviation.
Yes.
And then he started the whole idea of commercial aviation and how you actually can make money from this and actually transport people across the U.S.
Yeah.
And to Europe at much faster speeds.
And and that's what he wanted to do. He wanted to break down barriers between people and bring them together through aviation.
Yeah. It's an amazing story. So if you haven't read that, I guess this is a summer reading podcast. You know, there's a couple of good books for you right there. Wind, Sand, and Stars and Lindbergh by Berg.
Okay. When he meets Anne Morrow, that was an amazing part of it. So she says of him that, you know, this idea of meeting this clear, direct, straight boy, how it had swept out all the other guys that she had ever met in her life. Those that were sophisticated, those that were artsy, those that were posers, and that, you know, her world, her beribboned, she said, embroidered world was smashed by meeting this guy. And I think what I love about...
And she came from a very influential, wealthy family.
Right.
Yeah.
And what I love about what Lindbergh did was he captured her imagination. There it is, guys. That's what you do. Capture her imagination. And she thought she was like for 20 years looking in puddles. And when she met him, it was clouds, stars, and birds. And so it's a very romantic book in that sense that he takes her and flies around the world with her. They went to Japan together in an open cockpit airplane.
Yeah, that's
unbelievable.
Hard to believe. Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, the romantic and all the bells and whistles and stars and all that. And yet their marriage was very rough at times.
Yes.
And it's a very honest book. It's not painting this romantic portrait. They just goo-goo-eyed each other all of life. He was a difficult man to live with because of his aspirations being gone a lot. There was that. And then she wasn't all that easy herself. So
No.
I like the honesty of that.
And then she meets Saint X, right? And from Wind, Sand, and Stars. And she gets infatuated with him. And him being the poet, and she's a writer herself. And so it's the full story. And that's what I think I really love about this book. You get the highs and the lows in this book. Again, losing his baby and that sort of thing, and what happened during World War II and being kind of on the wrong side of that, and then seeing his whole life. And I tell you, the end of it started to get emotional. And I unfortunately finished the book on a long flight. And so I'm reading it in the flight deck.
Hopefully you weren't flying.
And
you weren't pilot command. Were you?
And here comes that emotional part where you could feel the tears coming up. And I'm like, there is no crying in the cockpit. And towards the end of his life, he's in New York and he's dying. And he's like, I don't want to die here. And so United takes most of first class out. They put a bed in there and a DC-8 and they fly him back to Hawaii. and he has about a week to figure this out. And so he writes his own epitaph for his tombstone. He put on, "If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand would find me." But he says something really interesting at the end. He says, "After my death, the molecules of my being will return to the earth and the sky, for they came from the stars. I am of the stars." I thought, wow, how poetic, how beautiful, and how brave to write that.
I'm of the stars?
Yeah.
Why is that brave?
Well, what do you do? Where do you go with that theologically, you know, in a sense?
Well, I think we'd all say we're from the heavens, so, you know.
Yeah, not many people, you know, I don't know. I think that's pretty brave. I'm interested in what you know. You're amazing. You can actually go outside and pick out Jupiter. Is that true?
I can.
Yeah. How many other stars can you just go out there and where did you learn the stars?
I just had a love for it as a kid, so I've always explored the heavens. Then you go up to my dad's place where you get a 360-degree view from a rock that in the middle of the night, where there's no light pollution, so you get the absolute pristine beauty of it all. But yeah, I had a telescope as a kid for a while, and those things are always more frustrating than you think. You get one, then it's so hard to work and find the operate, and things move. And just,
yeah.
So I never become proficient at it, but I've always had interest in the stars and space travel and all those kinds of things have been an important part of my journey. I think I would have loved to have been an astronaut if I hadn't had claustrophobia issues. I think that would have been tough.
It is tough.
Capsule with three guys
and going
to the moon.
I can't imagine.
I can't get out of here for days. That would freak you out.
But, yeah. I know. You know, when Kennedy visited the capsules, his back was so bad, he couldn't actually get in the capsule. But what he perfected was the looking up at the stars. So they would put him in there looking up. And that was the big tagline for that. But yeah, I couldn't imagine it. But
So where were you on July 20th, 1969?
Oh, man, there were things that happened in my life that I could remember going back. And I can remember my mother crying twice. The day Kennedy got shot and the day I remember her pulling me off the field and going, "You need to come and watch this." And that was when, of course, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin walked on the moon. And she was just sitting there in tears. And I'm sitting there watching it going, okay, this is what I want to do.
What field were you in on a Sunday?
But I remember being pulled off a field. Now, was it the next day? Because it would have been at night, right?
It was at night out. It was late afternoon out here in California. So, yeah, it would nighttime.
Yeah, would have been night. Wherever I was, where I was playing, she says, "Hey, you need to come watch this."
Oh, you were playing in the field.
Yeah. I was out somewhere, and she calls me in and says, "You need to come and see this."
I was 16 years old. I was working on my first summer jobs, and I was cleaning a department store called Roscoe in Selma, California. And I was trying to get this thing done because I was hoping I get home in time to watch this. I've been looking forward to this forever. I've been following the whole flight to the moon and the separation and going down to the moon surface. I got to get home for the landing, man. I just got to get home. And I made it. I made it home. It was a Sunday afternoon, 16 years old, and sitting there with my family watching that whole experience, the landing first, and then later they actually getting out onto the surface. And it's just hard to go out and look at the moon. You never look at the moon the same way again.
No,
we've been there.
Yeah.
Amazing stuff.
Oh, definitely. Unbelievable.
And so now we just saw Apollo 11, I think it was called. It's one movie that's just kind of a documentary. It's just all the video and
they put
audio
it together.
From that time.
Like a documentary.
Yeah, it's like that, but there's no narration. It's all original voices, the news people, Walter Cronkite, others, having their say. That was very nostalgic for Sarah and I, having lived through that. And then watching, there was a movie too, where they act out Neil Armstrong's landing on the moon and that whole thing and more acted out. And we just saw that recently. So things are really ramping up here for the 50th anniversary.
Oh, definitely. okay, I got a question for you. Do you know where they found the first drawings of the Zodiac? What people group put the first? Okay, all right. Well, thanks for asking me. I'll come in with that one.
This is demonic stuff here.
2,000 years B.C., they figure the very first drawings of the Zodiac came from Mesopotamia. And the reason that they can figure that is by the latitude of what they could see and what stars there were. So if it was in Egypt, it would have been too far south, or if it was in Israel, it would have been too far north. And so they did a very extensive archaeological dig in the summer of the Euphrates River. And there was one elevated area there that they had what they called the Temple of the Moon there. And so these people worshipped the moon. So a woman has a 30-day cycle. The moon has a 30-day cycle, but the woman dies, but the moon is still up there. And so it was eternal, and they were worshiping there. And that area that was raised was called Ur of Chaldees. And so that's where Abraham was from.
Yep.
And so when God says to him, hey, look at the dust of the earth, so shall your nation be. Then there's that little crucifixion scene in Genesis 15. And then after that, he goes, now look up and look at the stars, so shall your nation be. That was significant for Abraham. And there was a new sheriff in town, because now they weren't worshiping, or you weren't to worship the stars. They were actually subject to you. And so I love that perspective of God going, now, hey, look up. These people, your nation, you're going to have one foot on the ground, dust of the earth, and there's going to be another life in you from above also. And so that's the tension, I think, that we live in, the way I read that, of having this other life in us. And that, in fact, there is something of this. And so what does Jesus do when he comes to the earth? He's identified by the wise men as a star. And so I love that.
By the star.
By the star. Yeah. So I love that analogy of, you know, this life from above.
Which really is not worshiping the stars, but the maker of the stars.
Right. That you're not subject to them. They're actually subject to you.
In what way?
In a sense that you own them, you know, so, that, well, first of all, what
we
I
own
what,
the
what,
stars?
No. There's something that, let's put it this way. When I look up, what that shows me is that there's something eternal. There's something, that I could count on. It's always going to be there. The stars tell me something about this life from above. And that's what I love about the perspective of looking up.
That there is just another, there's a reality beyond the one that we see here every day. And we get fixated on our earthly home and our earthly realities. And the whole sense of the vastness of the universe and how big it is, and we're a tiny speck in the whole thing.
Yeah.
And really, we're created. We were created for another reality, another city, and another home that's going to be ours someday. And I don't mean just heaven beyond the stars. I don't mean that. I mean there's a reality that takes us beyond this globe into the cosmos that God has created. And man, I don't have a clue what that means.
Yeah.
I get excited about that.
I do too.
I don't know
I'm
what it means.
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
it's expansive.
I have no idea. Yeah, it is expansive.
Yeah, and that this world isn't it. You know, there's so much more to come.
Yep.
Is what I love about that. And so when I think about going to the moon, what I love was that scene I showed you in that book, From the Earth to the Moon. And From the Earth to the Moon was actually a book written by Jules Verne. And he wrote it in 1865. And in the book, he predicts that America will beat the Russians, English, French, to the moon. And he thinks that we're going to launch from the tidal waters of Florida, and that it'll take us 4 days to get to the moon. And of course, it only took us 3 days to get there. So amazing accuracy. But when Kennedy grows up, he's reading Jules Verne. He actually enjoys this. And so when we go to the moon eventually, what I love was when they got up there, they looked at the moon and they thought, what a desolate place this is. No one would want to live here. And they look back at the earth and it's outstandingly beautiful. And so where the people in Abraham's day were worshiping the moon, we went up to the moon and said, no, actually, look at that good earth. That's where you want to live. And I think that's one of the things our country did. And I love that.
Hmm. And what is it about these things? This is always a capturing of, as long as I've known you, Jeff, the joy of adventure, the joy of the unknown, the joy of moving beyond the maps. What is it that, because all this is not just love of history and love of flying and love of plotting courses. It really, there's a deeper adventure in your heart.
Oh, definitely.
Talk about that a little bit.
I think they say that when you learn aeronautics, you know, how to fly down here, when you go to astronomics, you have to forget aeronautics to learn how to go astronaut. And I think it's the same way with this life that God gives us. I think we're born of the earth. We learn its ways, how to survive, how to grow. And then we get this new life in us. And how do we begin to navigate with this new life from above? And honestly, I think that's what you and Brad do. You guys help us in this transition of how do we begin to navigate by this mysterious life of God in us that looks so different than the laws and precepts that we learn in this life.
I think part of the God journey too is realizing that we've mostly traded that away. I mean, I think Jesus opens a marvelous adventure to us, learning to be people of the Spirit. The thing we use for the publishing company, windblown, you know, where
yeah.
you don't know where it comes from or where he's going, so is everyone led by the Spirit. There's this movement in a human heart that takes them beyond reason, and
yes.
not to irrationality, and not
right.
to stupidity, and
no.
not to all that, but there's a different way to gauge how you navigate a circumstance,
mm-hmm.
People in your life.
Yeah.
There's a way to navigate that has God's wisdom and God's realities in it.
Yeah.
And instead of us, this is what frustrates me about the religion we call Christianity, instead of teaching people how to navigate their lives inside the reality of who God is and mm-hmm. a growing trust in him, we've reduced Christianity to a set of rules and principles, and well, we joked about last time, a roadmap. Here's a little map. Stay in this little map. Here's mm-hmm. what you're supposed to do. Don't do this. And don't think you can talk to God and God's going to talk to you, because we just know that's not going to work and you're going to end up shooting your neighbor. You know, that's what Son of Sam did, and he killed people. So we're not going to listen to God. We're not going to go. And we've just made this safe little religious thing that's absolutely mm-hmm. boring to most men.
Yeah.
And probably women too.
Yeah. Yeah, without a doubt.
And Jesus came to offer us the greatest adventure in the world. You know what, Jeff? I can put my Spirit in you.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to give you insights you've never had before mm-hmm. about things. And he's going to invite you into realities that look absurd to the rational mind and yet hold great weight and reality in the world you live in. And I want to invite you to, like you said, get off of aerodynamics, which is all about, you know, friction and
yep.
and air and all those kinds of things. You get to space, there's no air, there's no friction. So all the dynamics of that kind of flying
yeah.
is just different. And I think Brad and I, we've talked for years on here, 15 years, to get people to think beyond
yes.
just navigating the map people give you and the rules you're asked to follow. Discover mm-hmm. who God is in your life, how he makes himself known, and go on a journey
yeah.
whose reality is based beyond this world.
Yes.
But not that old, you know, so heavenly minded, no earthly good stuff. But coming to a place of, man, God's a real point in my life. Yeah, I don't know him completely. So I'm going to see things in fits and starts and bits
yeah.
and pieces. And I'm going to lean into things I think are God and find out they're more Wayne than God. And then I'm going to lean back out of that and then find, oh, this is where God wants me. But, oh, my gosh, that looks scary. And if God doesn't come through there, I'm going to be left all alone. Great. Keep leaning into that space. And I don't think most people who've been enculturated in Christianity have the courage or the insight to lead into that space.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's where the adventure is. That's what I think I've enjoyed in my relationship with you, with Brad,
oh, yeah.
with others, is,
oh, yeah.
man, there's a reality in God that
yes.
does take you beyond the maps. And yes, it makes the map makers nervous. It
yeah.
makes the people around you
who want
to control
because
you.
Because you can't control it. That's
yeah,
exactly it.
That's the point.
Yeah.
And they can't profit from it. That's the other point. There's such a income model behind almost everything Christianity does. And God doesn't work that way. God invites us to live by what's real and what's true, not what makes me money or makes me popular.
You know what I love about the city is it puts you there.
The
it
city,
you,
for those who don't know.
It puts you in the kingdom, and you start to learn about the ways of this kingdom up there.
Let's back up a little bit. That's the book we've been talking about a little bit, just because it's a book I've been working on with this lady from France. And I just finished it. I finished it on Friday. I'm done. We had some final edits today, and that's going to an editor. We looked to have it out probably the first of the year, but I gave you a copy because I wanted you to comment on it. I want you to let me know what you thought of it. And, you know, I know we're torturing people. I can't read it yet. You will. It's not that far from now. We're going to actually have pre-orders and get this book in people's hands. If we were going to a normal publisher, we would now be a year out from publishing at this stage. And the reason we're not is because I don't want you to wait that long. So we're going to try and do another self-published venture and start a new publishing company and see where it goes. So you were talking about that. You've read it. You're not finished with it yet.
Yeah.
So you have actually got to the best parts of it.
Right.
But you've got to some really good parts.
Oh, yeah. Hall of Mirrors. You're going to love it. But I want to give you an example of that. I just got back from Cape Canaveral. Me and my wife went down there. And I love the idea of how to engross myself in a subject. I like to read about it, watch it, and go there. So I
go touch it
and see it. Yeah. Yeah. And my wife's grandfather was a hypergolic expert, and so he was actually down there working on the Apollo
a space hypo program. Who?
Hypergolic. Okay, so
what's a hypergolic?
All right, do you remember when that spaceship was in the orbit of the moon, and the engine had to start to get out of that orbit,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's not like your car when you're sitting there turning it over with your key, hoping that it'll start. What they do is they open up two valves, and these gases and liquids have just spontaneous combustion, and that's hypergolic. So you don't.
So the propulsion system.
You really know what you need. You need to know what you're doing there, because you won't live very long if you're not good at hypergolic, because it's highly explosive. But that's what those guys did. They kept the engines running. So it was a great visit. I read Moonshot about Kennedy and the 50th anniversary. And then I watched From the Earth to the Moon, and that was that series done by Tom Hanks and Ron Howard.
Yep.
So if you want to engross yourself in that, it's amazing what you can learn about this experience. But one of the things I wanted to tell you was Alan Shepard was the first guy up in space, right? He was the first one in the Mercury program. But eventually, they let him go to the moon. So he was one of the 12 that actually walked on there. And he's a very scientific mind, astronaut, you know, fighter pilot, the whole thing. But when he turned back and he looked at the Earth, he just started bawling. He was overcome with emotion. And one of the reasons was he couldn't believe that it was so beautiful. How could we be at war there? And of course, the Vietnam War was going on at that. How could people be angry at one another looking back? And I think that perspective, that heavenly perspective, gives us the right perspective of how to live on this Earth.
Wow! By looking, so we got to go to the moon to get this view.
Well, we got to experience that right here in our spirit. But I think we.
It doesn't seem to change things, does it? When we have guys come back profoundly affected by looking at the Earth as a little green and blue marble in the distance, come back profoundly altered. I've talked about it, and yet there's more unrest and war and all that crap in the Earth today than ever. Mm-hmm. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think when you meet God, though, you drop a lot of your anxiety and your anger and your frustration. And that's what I'm talking about, that heavenly perspective.
You know?
And that's what I love about the city and how that shows up in Leo's life. But
I had somebody just write me and say, I'd never read a book that outlined better the difference between the kingdom now, the kingdom come, and the kingdom yet to come, and how we live in that tension, which... Mm-hmm. I agree. I think it's a great point in that. So,
okay, so I want to tell you a little story. And during World War II, this guy grows up in Germany, and his name is Werner von Braun, and he's a rocket guy. Loves rockets. Hears about Goddard here in the States, and he's kind of a mentor of him, and wants to build these rockets. And he gets pretty good at it. But World War II breaks out, and von Braun signs up as a patriot for his country. But Hitler quickly starts to see the benefit in this rocket technology and begins to employ him to make rockets for
weaponizing
this gift. Von Braun wants to just launch these babies into space, but Hitler's got some deleterious motives here. And so he eventually builds the V2 rocket. So here's his chance to now actually get funding to build the rockets, but he's got to put a warhead on them. And these V2 rockets eventually start to hit England. Well, Hitler wants to really have these things go all the way over the ocean, and he would like to see Boston, New York, Washington burn, just like his cities were during the Allied bombings. And so it doesn't happen. The boys come across Europe after D-Day, shut the operation down. Von Braun knows it's at the end of the war, and he runs to the Americans. He takes all of his technology, everything he knows. He doesn't want to be captured by the Russians, goes over to the Americans, and is brought to the States, but Eisenhower is president. Eisenhower doesn't trust von Braun. He's an SS guy, or former SS, and he doesn't see the importance of rockets. And so eventually, von Braun meets Kennedy. Now, Kennedy was eating up Jules Verne, understood the idea of going to the moon. And now Kennedy meets his accomplice in this, in von Braun, and they have this instantaneous relationship. And eventually, Kennedy puts him, after becoming president, over NASA, and he then takes us to the moon. And I think what's so unbelievable about that story is that the very worst things, which was Hitler and these V2 bomb, turns into one of really the highlight of our country, of going to the moon in Apollo. And if anybody understood the American dream, it would have to be von Braun, going from the SS, which he completely repented of having been part of that, to building these rockets and then going up into space. And it's just this great story, because if you think about, you know, what could be the worst thing that could ever happen in the world would be the killing of God. And yet that turned out to be the salvation of the world. And so here in von Braun, you know, he's got these V2, what could be the worst thing, then turns into the Apollo 11 mission. And I think it's the same way in our life. I think the very worst things in life have the possibility, not always, but have the possibilities of actually becoming the very best things in our life.
He's also got, you got the whole cycle there, don't you? You have the creating this thing to do something good, and then it's co-opted to weaponize it.
Yes.
And then get, so we have that whole cycle in our lives too, don't we?
Yeah, totally.
That, yeah, we take something beautiful and then make it ugly, and then God has the capacity of something really ugly
and turning
and
it
make
into
it something,
something
really
something
good.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so good to see that. I was in the cockpit one day, and it was a 7.5. I was in Washington, and I'm loading up the computer. And as I'm loading it up, I saw an older guy in the doorway, and I didn't think anything of it, because at the time, the 757 was like the Millennium Falcon. It was a flat screens, and everybody wanted to crank their neck and look up into the cockpit. And I turned around. I finished loading up the computer. I turned around. The guy is still there. And so I invite him up, and sure enough, he comes up, shakes my hand, says, "Hey, man, thanks for getting this big airplane into Washington National. You guys do an amazing job." And it was Buzz Aldrin. And I went right back to that scene in my living room with my mom crying and watching. And I turn around, I'm like, "No, you're the one that started this whole thing for me." And so we had this amazing love fest in the cockpit. But eventually he signed a picture for me, and he said, "Ad astra per aspera." And that's a Latin verse for through adversity to the stars. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about the cross. It truly is the power of God, you know, and it releases us from death, and that there is death in our life, and we understand that, but that there's resurrection. And so going back to von Braun for just a second, when Kennedy was shot, von Braun was devastated. Again, a man of science, and he just bawled openly when the president was assassinated. And he went over when none of the engineers were watching, and he inscribed the initials of JFK on the Saturn I rocket that they launched about 10 days after Kennedy was shot. And that, in a sense, there was a little bit of resurrection there for von Braun. But of course, von Braun takes us all the way to the moon.
And I like what the cross did, and you talk about it, and it resolving death and resurrection.
Yeah.
That's just not, I know when people hear that stuff, they think about the end of life and the resurrection, but actually now too,
yes.
You know, the death that works in us because mm-hmm. of the appetites of humanity and the temptations of darkness and all the death that works in us. The whole idea of the cross was now life can work
yes.
in you. And
yes.
now we can go a different course mm-hmm. and find our way into that reality we were talking about a little while ago, that God lives in you, God dwells in you, and there's a way to discern who he is and what he's doing and go on that journey with him. And that, to me, that's the greatest adventure of all.
Yeah. I could get discouraged. I could look at how much death there is, but it's especially when I see people going through it, I say, hang in there, because there's resurrection too. And when that comes, that is such a beautiful thing. And I've even seen where it's not so much the enemy that brings this sort of death. Sometimes there's a little dismantling that God does in our lives in order to bring us to a new place and to a new frontier. And I think that's what I love about the frontier, is when you go out there and there are no maps, it's really sometimes the first time we pray our real prayers, because we're absolutely dependent on him. And of course, that's what he did with Abraham. You know, he didn't bring him into a classroom. He said, "Let's go. We're going on a journey together." And this I see Jesus did the same thing. He took 12 guys on a 3-year high adventure camping trip that they had no idea what was coming next. And how we've made Christianity a classroom scenario. I understand that a little bit. You know, there's nothing like a little good book time, but it's an adventure to live.
Yeah, one of the things that one of my favorite lines in the city, and we've said it before publicly, is these things are better explored than they are explained.
Yeah, amen.
And that, there's nothing that's more true of than the life of Jesus.
Yeah,
we can go to seminars. We've explained it to death, literally.
Yeah.
Instead of let people explore what this amazing adventure is to know God, not in complete, not completeness. It's the joy of know in part, see in part, get glimpses, follow the glimpses, see what doors that open. Mm. It's always an adventure. Mm. We are always leaning toward a city whose builder and maker is God, and we are not there yet.
Yeah.
But we get to lean into it.
Yeah, I know. And as much as I want to make this place home, and I try really hard to do it, it's not.
That's awesome.
There was a guy in the New York Times that actually wrote something really well after the Apollo moon landing. He said the great achievement of men on the moon is not only that they made history, but that they expand man's vision of what history might be. One moon landing doesn't make a new heaven and a new earth, but it has dramatized the possibilities of doing so. And I think that that's what we do. As we explore this world, we show this world there's a new one to come.
Okay. Well, that's got to be the last word. Thanks, Jeff, for coming out.
You bet. Enjoy
Good
it.
Talk to you.
Thank you. Uh-huh.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.